My name is Avital. I live in Jerusalem. After October 7th, the word Amalek was used a lot in Israel, and I found that very hard. It's always a moral issue, the story of Amalek. It's this time of year, around Purim, it comes up, and, you know, we go to the Hasidut, and we say, Amalek shebalev, Amalek that's in our hearts. That's what we're talking about when we talk about destroying Amalek. And maybe on a normal year, that's good enough, but this year it wasn't. And at some point I said to myself, Tov, you have no choice. You have to open up the verses. So that's what we're going to do together. I imagine most of you have seen this text before. Those who haven't, did you see anything surprising? And those who have, share something that you saw for the first time, a question that came up that you haven't had before. Yes, David.
The difference between remembering Amalek as one person and Amalek being a people, a whole group of individuals.
Sometimes they're and sometimes it feels like they're an individual, yeah? Okay, good. Yes.
At the end of the scene where God says to Moses, write this down as a zikaron, a sefer, that makes sense. But then it says, v'sim ba'oznei Yehoshua. Why does Joshua specifically need to hear this? Why isn't it ba'oznei kol am Yisrael or something like that? What's the role of Joshua here?
Nachon. Great question. We have now... They let go a lot of the miluimnikim, a lot of the reserve duty people have come back. And it's my association. It's just interesting the process that they're going through. First of all, they've been away for so long that they get 5 days of as soldiers just to do the transition slowly, both therapy, and they meet therapists and so on, do all kinds of things, and they get another 5 days at home, not having to go yet back to work. So it's a process, and in my association, it's connected to the post-war process of those who were in the battle, right? You're saying Joshua has a different role in this than Moshe, okay? So we have to elaborate what exactly, why the focus on him. Yeah.
And to jump off what Neil just said, we had a question with the second part of that verse. What is the function of the phrase, I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven? Why is it being said to Joshua, who just vanquished Amalek? So first, is Amalek dead? The memory, we don't know if Amalek is dead, but also, is it a comfort? Is it to affirm what he did? Is it perhaps that Joshua had a very fierce battle with Amalek? And Moses is saying, now we're gonna blot out his memory. So we're just wondering what the function of that phrase is in the moment with Joshua.
I thought you were going to say the opposite. Mm-hmm. He just had a fierce battle. Maybe he even killed him or them. And now he's being told, you're not alone. Mm-hmm. This is an endeavor of all of us, of God, of something like... Now, maybe... It moves scene, right? It's not on the battlefield necessarily in the same way, but yeah, interesting. Okay, yes.
I was struck by the word that they steadied his hand. That the word in English is steady, but the word in Hebrew is emunah. And in terms of Moses, it keeps flipping from the religious to the militaristic. That whole idea of, was it Moses' faith that was flailing, which is when he would put his hand down. And especially when they say that he named it Adonai Nisi, that God was trying me. Where's all that connection? What's being said here?
Beautiful. I'm just going to, for everyone, you see the verse, thus his hands remained steady. Erase the words, remained steady, and put in emunah. Now we have to think what that means. I think different traditions paint it in different ways. Turning up towards God, right? Like the Midrashim say. Or is it like Birkat Kohanim? right, towards the people, or is it just an act? Like, what is it exactly?
I have questions about the order of events.
Okay.
Like, Amalek came and fought. Does that mean Amalek provoked the conflict? Because then it says Moses said, okay, now go pick some people and go fight. Right. Is it like Amalek sort of lined up to fight, and then Moses came out, and then they, you know, then they brawled, or was it an ambush first, and this is the response? Mm-hmm. Why is it not enough of an emergency to like mobilize the entire army? This is just like a hand-picked unit of troops. Mm. Not the entire regular army, or like all the possible fighting.
That's a good question. We'll back to the parlanu, to the pick, but it manyan. Yes.
Amalek is referred to in human terms, meaning that Amalek, obviously it's a very, very serious condemnation, but Amalek is not referred to as a monster or somehow non-human. And I just wanted to call that out in light of everything, that Amalek, despite Amalek's evil, is still part of humanity.
I have three thoughts about that. One, to the degree that people are using Amalek for today's situation, it's important to note vis-a-vis Hamas, Palestinians, whatever you want. Number two, it's amazing how in our tradition they are ultimate evil. Kilo, how did that happen? Kilo, because it's not the way it is b'psukim, in the verses. Number three, it's very obvious, but what I was able to articulate to myself at the beginning of the war was that animals don't do cruelty for the sake of cruelty. Eve is a human attribute. And, you know, it mamash was with the parashot, right, with the portions of the week, and to kind of hit Noach with that realization, yeah, nachon, it's a human thing to do evil. Yeah. Vayavo Amalek vayilachem im Yisrael berefidim. Amalek came and fought with Israel berefidim. The function of the opening verse is not clear. Is the opening verse the title? Or is the opening verse what happens first? I think I was definitely used to reading it like the beginning of the story. Amalek started, there's no question. Vayavo Amalek vayilachem im Yisrael berefidim. They come and they start a war. But I think this could be the title. And then it starts with Moshe saying, go pick people and start this war. It's never clear who starts, right? Not in the living room between my kids, right? They'll never know who started, and not in the battlefield, because context is just so complicated and rich, and it's just hard to decipher who started. It's magical to me that the verses are able to hold that. Now we want to understand why they came, to where they came, who came.
I also found it interesting in terms of they say that's a Rephidim. Maybe Rephidim had a special place for Amalek, for the people of Amalek, and therefore they felt like they were... we don't know that. Why that place was...
Me'ule. Great. So in 1 minute, we'll look at the beginning of the chapter, and that might give it an answer. But also I want to say, who said... This slave, you said, they're these slaves. They suddenly come, this huge group of people, into the desert. Deserts don't have endless resources. Okay? Amalek is a tribe that lived there, had sheep that grazed there, and suddenly these Bnei Israel come, and they're going to take the resources, and there aren't enough. So it's possible that it's pashut, a tribal war, over resources. We can broaden it a bit more and say, here come these Bnei Israel with the promise of conquering Shivat HaAmamim and the right and Eretz Knaan. That's where they're headed. Everyone's nervous about this group of people that's declaring that that's what they're about to do. So maybe there's some, I don't know, representatives sent by a first test to see who these people are that are threatening to come to Eretz Knaan and take it over. We've encountered Amalek before. Esav's grandson, Vetimna Haita Pilegesh Le'Eliphaz, Ben Esav. So Esav, Eliphaz, Vateled Le'Eliphaz et Amalek. But Amalek is the son of the Pilegesh, right? He's the son of the concubine. So he's already not fully accepted in the family. Vayazed Yaakov Nezid, right? He's cooking Yaakov. Vayavo Esav min hasadeh v'hu ayef. You see that the word ayef is not a neutral word, right? It connects us to the other narrative about the story. Okay, where Yisrael is ayef. Beseder, so here it's Esav who's ayef. Vayomer Esav el Yaakov, he's tired. Give me some of this red thing. I'm exhausted. Ki ayef anochi. Okay? Vayomer Yaakov. And Yaakov takes advantage of the weakness of Esav. And in a minute, Amalek is going to take advantage of the weakness of Bnei Israel. Okay, so this doesn't happen in neutral context, even in the Torah. And of course, the most blatant, Vayomer Yaakov el Aviv Anochi Esav Bechorecha. Right? Yaakov says to his father, I am Esav. He lies in order to get the bracha. So I'm just saying, there's baggage. Even if we don't imagine tribes fighting in the desert, Amalek is not neutral, doesn't come out of the blue. Okay? Amalek is holding being mistreated by his brother, by Yaakov, okay? Bnei Israel. So that's another piece of context. Now we can peek at Refidim. And the beginning of the chapter is seemingly a totally different story. But it'll help us with a few things. First of all, it will remind us what happens with the staff usually, how the staff is usually used. And number two, it'll tell us something about Refidim. And number three, it'll tell us something about the state of mind of Israel. So Bnei Israel, right, they're just out of Egypt. They just crossed the Red Sea. Mamash, they've been out for a minute. And they park in Refidim. And what happens classically in the desert? En maim lishtot. There's no water. And what do the people do? They start arguing. Vayera va'ami Moshe. Okay? They're furious. And Moshe says to them, Ma terivuni medi? What do you want from me? And why are you testing God? Tenasun. Nusach appears again and again and again in the whole chapter. It's a miracle. It's a staff. Kes, it rings familiar from what happens at the end there with Amalek. The people are thirsty. They complain. Moshe cries out to God. Okay? And then what happens? Vayomer Hashem el Moshe. God says to Moshe, take umatcha, hamateh, right? The staff with which you hit the ye'or to create makat dam and which turned into a snake in front of Paro and which you used to open the Red Sea, right? That's the staff. Take that staff, okay? Because I'm going to help you and hit the rock and water will come out of the rock. Just let's read the last verse so that we hear the atmosphere into which Amalek appears. The place was named Masa Umeriva because the Israelites quarreled and because they tried God, saying, is God present among us? Okay, that is Refidim. In modern Hebrew, you use the word Rifyon. Rifyon is limp and that you don't hold yourself. Rafui is to let go. Okay, if I'm holding the pen and ani marpa, I let go. So they are spiritually weak. Refidim is the place where you let go. Okay, that's where Amalek appears. After we've fought with God and tested God and so on. So we don't know who started, but we know Amalek has baggage. We know the state of the Israelites is not good with God. They're testing God. They're testing Moshe. And into this, Vayomer Moshe el Yehoshua b'char lanu anashim. I've been thinking about this a lot because I have 2.5 kids in the army. I have 2 kids in the army and 1 in 12th grade, so he's almost in. First of all, even if you leave aside the whole story with the ultra-Orthodox in Israel, let's be honest, societies choose who go to war. There is never a society where everybody goes to war. Societies make choices, and it reflects on their values. Second thing I want to say, the Mechilta brings a dispute between Rabbi Yehoshua and Rabbi Elazar. And they discuss who Yehoshua chose. Rabbi Yehoshua says, Giborim, warriors or heroes. And Rabbi Elazar HaModa'i says, Fearers of sin, Yirei Chet. So first of all, I just like that imagining. What does the battlefield look like when it's all these people who are very cautious and afraid of sin, right? What does that battlefield look like versus the warriors, okay? There's another, in Esther Rabba, there's the most beautiful one, which I think everybody's fantasy. Im ba'alei kshafim hem, choose the sorcerers, right? I think it's our fantasy that there's magic in war and it's over, right? But that's not the way it works. And the last thing I want to add with the B'char Lanu Anashim, Sefer Dvarim, the book of Deuteronomy, says who goes to war, okay? Or really, it lists who doesn't go to war, okay? So who doesn't go to war?
Somebody who hasn't concluded his marriage, somebody who hasn't finished building a house, somebody who's planted a vineyard and not reaped it.
In other words, right? You're the beginning of the relationship, but you haven't yet lived it out. You just started a business and you haven't yet reaped the fruit. You just built a new institution, a new house, and you haven't yet lived in it. I'll finish my sentence and I'll let you, David. It's the opposite choice of what's happening today in Israel, and I think here also. Right? According to Sefer Dvarim, me and my friends should be going to war, not our kids. Okay? And that is also an interesting choice of who a society decides they can sacrifice. You know, we can tell ourselves that it's about they're stronger. There's no doubt my sons are stronger than me, but I don't know. I'm also aware of the choice that's made there and that it's different of the prescriptive choice of the Torah. Okay, let's get to Moshe. Just because we're doing a careful read of the text, I want you to forget that there's a capital T in the middle of the third line, right in the middle of the second pasuk. And I want you to notice that in the Hebrew, it's not clear what happens today and what happens tomorrow. Okay? Whoever added the te'amim of how to read it made a choice. Bidyuk, they decided war today, Moshe and his gang tomorrow. But it's not clear from the verse itself what happens today, what happens tomorrow. Now, having just seen it, I want to say there was no choice but the army to start working on October 7th. And somebody said here, the religious leadership, I must admit that I'm thinking of them more as, how do you say a derega medini? The political, maybe. In other words, there's the army and there's the politicians. It's not clear to me if on the mountain are the religious leaders or the politicians. And obviously Moshe is a mixture, so I can't differentiate. But not clear to me what role he's playing here. Now, you could read the story just of what happened in the battlefield, right? Moshe says to Yoshua, choose people, go fight Amalek. Yoshua does what Moshe says to him, fights Amalek. And Yoshua wins. That's one story. And now I want to spend a little bit of time looking at the other story that happens on the mountain. And it's a separate story. And the two are mixed in the psukim, in the verses, but it's a separate story. And Moshe's first intuition is to take et matea Elohim, to take the staff. But there's one very, very big significant difference between this taking of the staff and all the others. Where's God? God is not there in the entire story. God appeared only as holding the memory. And Moshe is desperate. Moshe really wants God to be there. And how does he invite God in? He takes the staff. That's the magic thing that always pulls God in. But here it doesn't work. God's not playing along here. God is slowly taking steps back to give independence to Israel. Now who's on the mountain? Moshe, Aharon, Vechur. Right, Yoshua's down fighting. And Moshe, Aaron, and Hur are up on the mountain. Who are Moshe, Aaron, and Hur? Give me some associations for Moshe.
They're all family.
Ah, they're all family. Connect Hur. So Moshe and Aaron, they're brothers, we know. Connect Hur in.
He's the son of...
Who's missing in the mountain if it's all siblings? Miriam. He's the son of... According to the Midrash, Hur is the son of Miriam. That's number one. Number two, let's just stereotype them. What do we know about Moshe? Give me some
prophet, angry.
Angry prophet. Stutterer. Yofi, what?
Stutterer.
Nachon.
Political versus priestly.
Yofi, he's more political. He's a prophet and political, right? And what about Aharon, Im Kvar, you started?
The Kohen, yeah.
He's the Kohen, he's the priest. What else?
Rodef
Shalom. Yofi, Ohev Shalom veRodef Shalom. That's our association with Hillel Omer, Eve mitalmidav shel Aharon, be of the students of Aharon, Ohev Shalom veRodef Shalom. Okay, not exactly the furious Moshe we just saw, right, getting mad at Bnei Israel for being thirsty. Okay, so a different kind of character. Now, the question is Chur. Who is Chur? Listen, there's one story about Chur that it's both heartbreaking and a story I like, so I'll bring it, we can read it together, just to, because there isn't much about him. But this story tells us why there isn't much about him. Rabbi Birchia, in the name of Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana, interpreted the verses with regard to Aharon. And he tells us the following story. When Israel did the deed, what's the deed with a capital T?
Golden
calf. Yofi, the golden calf. Beseda, what we just read, did the deed. At first, they went to Chur. They miss Moshe, they miss Moshe, they miss Moshe. The first thing they do is they go to Chur, because the verses tell us that Aharon and Chur stayed down. They said to him, "Get up and make for us a god." When he didn't listen to them, they came upon him and they killed him. And partially they say this about Chur because he's not mentioned anymore after the golden calf. What I want to say is that the rabbis stereotyped these three people, Moshe, Aaron, and Chur, very differently. And so the first thing to notice is that unlike the battlefield, where there's one person, one voice, right? The Ramatkal has to have, the chief of staffs has to have one person, one voice. On the mountain, the political or the religious leadership is diverse, okay? The political leadership is diverse. You can start hearing my criticism of my own country. Now we have to see what happens there, because it's not just diversity. I don't know what to do with the fourth verse, because the biggest question about verse number 4, right, when Moshe picks up his hands, Israel wins, and Moshe puts down his hands, Amalek wins. Why did he put down his hands? Nachon, if the war is up to his hands, who puts down their hands at that moment? Okay, so you're saying there's some weakness here, and if it's spiritual weakness, even if it's physical weakness, maybe I'm not in control of it. So, but there's something happening. The classic midrash here is that the hands enable, create, do something to the belief, the faith of the people fighting, okay? And so the hands coming down is a weakening of the faith, okay? And the hands coming up enable, pashut, this movement, right? That's it. And then I suddenly remember what I need to remember, okay? Also on the battlefield. So Moshe's hands were heavy, and they take a stone and they put it under him. And Moshe sits on the stone. It's a funny response, right? I guess it's because he's old. They think if he sits, he'll have more energy in his hands. What I like most about this description is that there's weakness. It's explicit. It's not a source of shame. And the support enables, generates, and is because of emunah. There's something cyclical about the ability to express weakness and the ability to support that both are based on trust and create trust. Emun and emunah, trust and faith, are connected in Hebrew. Emun is trust and emunah is faith. And also in English, I think, you can have faith in somebody like you trust them, right? It took me a long time to understand what the emunah here is doing, but I actually think it's hinting to God, but it's primarily on the human level, okay, that there is trust and faith between the three of them, and that's what enables the politicians, the religious leaders, to kind of work together and give strength to what's happened to the battlefield, okay, something like that. Vayachalosh Yoshua et Amalek ve'et Amor lefichar. Vayachalosh is a very strange verb. It's a very rare verb. Ki'ilu, it's from to weaken, right? Yoshua weakened them from the word chalash. But lachlosh is also when you, like, have a whole area. cholesh. It's what you see from the mountain when you see the whole area, at the cholesh al haezor. So it's also like to be in control, something like that. I want to say something about what it means to, about the commandment of Machot Imched Zecher Amalek. Number one, I want to say that I want to just remind us of the term a palimpsest. When you write on klaf, on parchment, it has thickness to it, okay? Now, it was very expensive. So you would erase the letters and write on it again. But the parchment would hold the old letters, okay? Because it was etched inside. It's like, think of a pencil when you erase. Even if you write over, the old letters are still there. What I want to say is that the act of erasing leaves memory. I think maybe this remember to erase and this ongoing act of erasing is aware of that. I'll give you another example just now with Purim. The first chapter is all about erasing. But there's a whole first chapter about Vashti, right? Achashverosh is furious. He just wants to erase her. But her story is there. Something that happens often, that our attempt to erase, that act of trying to forget, leaves an imprint. Things leave an imprint on us, okay? And I think the tension here between remembering and forgetting is partially an awareness of that. Number two, at the end of the day, I went back to these verses because I was interested to understand what it means, the tzav, the requirement, limchot et amalek. And I want to end by giving three interpretations of what it means. Look, if Amalek, which is where we started, if Amalek is the ultimate evil, if Amalek is the ultimate evil, then erasing Amalek is erasing the ultimate evil. It's how people used it around October 7th in Israel, right? The more we realized, the more horrors that happened there, the more it was easy to kind of attribute, associate Hamas and Amalek, and if they're ultimate evil, we have to do away with them, and that's that, right? It's not very complicated. Now, I am aware that it's a cultural choice to give the name, the quality, Amalek, every generation to somebody new. Okay? And that is our cultural choice, right? Not to let go of that entity, but to always attribute it to somebody. Okay? That's the first possibility. Possibility number two has to do with the narrative in Dvarim. Remember what Amalek did to you, baderech, on the way after you left Egypt, or when you were leaving Egypt. Asher karcha baderech, that he happened upon you on the way, vayezanev becha kol hanichshalim acharecha. And I think if we're looking for a source for why Amalek is considered evil, this is it. Amalek comes and hurts the weak people. Okay, vayezanev becha kol hanichshalim acharecha. When ve'ata ayef ve'yagea, you are tired and weary and not God-fearing. Even if I leave aside the description of Israel as tired and weary and not God-fearing, this is Amalek, right? Amalek is the entity that attacks the weakest. Then if I want to do away with Amalek, limchot et Amalek, the act I need to engage in is making sure there are no weak elements in my society. Not stam Hamas hit where it did. We call it the periferia, right? The periphery, okay? Those places on the edge that were deserted by the army, deserted by the country, few people, many of the cities are very poor and downtrodden. And suddenly, what I'm supposed to do changes focus completely, right? One possibility is what you need to do is do away with all the evil. But the other possibility is what I need to do is make sure I don't have a society that can be attacked. I have to strengthen society. I'll just say one more thing, that if I have frustration, it's because the leadership is defining the goal of the war about Hamas and not about me, right? I want the goal of the war to be that I can live peacefully. you know, not even thinking of that everyone leave peacefully, but even that, there's nobody saying. The third is the following, okay? If the first read says, Amalek is the evil and we have to do away with it, and the second is, Amalek is that who attacks the weak, and so we have to make sure there's no weak. The third is a suggestion that Amalek is a worldview, which is dichotomous. A worldview where there are good guys and bad guys, where there's Amalek and there's us, and so on and so forth. And limchot et zecher Amalek is to basically accept that things are more complicated, that we're all in this gray. It connects to the question of who started. The inability to answer that question is part of the story. I feel sometimes that it's an act of maturity that is required of Bnei Israel, that limchot et zecher Amalek is to accept that there is no simple good guys and bad guys, and you just have to do away with the bad guys. We have this fantasy that we'll just get rid of the bad guys and it's all going to be okay. But reality is different. The number three is that limchot et zecher Amalek means to accept that it's complicated. And now with that understanding, start tackling life.